content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. We'll begin today with, Why is the U.S. running so low on weapons? Written by Phillips Payson O'Brien. He's a professor of strategic studies at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. Although the United States has been the world's preeminent military power for decades, it apparently cannot fight a regional power such as Iran for more than a few months before experiencing an armaments crisis. Since hostilities with Tehran began on February 28th, the U.S. has reportedly used up two-thirds of its Patriot missile interceptors, more than a third of its Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, or THAAD, interceptors, and a third or more of its pre-war stock of Tomahawk cruise missiles. The rate of consumption is all the more striking because a shaky ceasefire had halted most fighting for months. Based on recent production patterns, replenishing the supply of weaponry will take several years. Making America's challenge still more daunting is a major shift in warfighting technology toward cheap, unmanned aerial vehicles. The United States and its allies in the Persian Gulf have been forced to use expensive, advanced air defense systems, such as the Patriot PAC-3 missiles, that each cost millions of dollars and have a long production cycle. To shoot down Iranian drones that can be swiftly assembled for about $30,000. The munitions shortfall doesn't just affect the current war. It also sends a worrisome message to allies around the world. The United States has been caught off guard by the latest evolution of warfare and lacks the armaments, production, capacity to adapt quickly. Suddenly, relying on American military technology looks far less reliable as a security strategy than it did before President Trump went to war with Iran. And in the long run, governments that counted on the United States to equip their military are going to need a Plan B. In the short term, concerns about diminished weapons stock are already limiting Washington's strategic options. Because of his advisor's concern about the adequacy of current supplies, Trump has reportedly been hesitant to escalate the war. If the United States decided to send ground forces into Iran on the scale necessary to keep the Strait of Hormuz open, defending those forces would exhaust the remaining stocks of advanced air defense systems. After a short period, American troops would be far more exposed and casualties far more likely. Trump and his appointees during his current and previous terms bear only part of the responsibility for the current situation. The fundamental problem has been a bipartisan neglect of America's military-industrial productive base over the past three decades. The United States allowed many of its strategic industries, such as shipbuilding, to wither. Its post-9/11 wars in Iraq and Afghanistan involved brief invasions, followed by years of relatively low-intensity counterinsurgency warfare that, whatever its difficulties, did not require mass stockpiles of munitions. Informed by these experiences, military planners appear to have been operating under the assumption that future wars would be short and containable. If China attacks Taiwan and the United States wants to come to the island democracy's aid, the Pentagon will not be prepared for a protracted war. Unfortunately, the Trump administration has failed to learn from the war in Ukraine. Iran has learned to mass-produce cheap drones, ones that the Russians first imported and now produce themselves. In other words, their effectiveness has been tested and their existence was widely known. But that seems to make no difference to U.S. planners. Perhaps in the arrogant belief that a war with Iran would quickly end in a decisive victory, the Pentagon did not have cost-effective systems ready to intercept these weapons. Neither did the Gulf countries that have counted on American weaponry for their self-defense. In contrast, Ukraine has proved remarkably adaptive to emerging conditions, creating a powerful strategic industry, as Ukraine has done in the case of air, land, and sea drones, not only helps with the country's security, it also provides a boost to Ukraine's economic and strategic position as governments in the Gulf and elsewhere seek to tap its expertise. The Gulf partners that build their militaries around equipment for the United States do so under the assumption that, in a moment of need, they can get what they require from the superpower. Perhaps the U.S. would even carry the burden of any war in the region. The perils of such assumptions are becoming apparent. Relying on another country for weapons is dangerous. Doing so may create a flashy frontline force with some advanced capabilities, but once the purchased equipment is destroyed or worn out, the military that bought it is left with troops trained on equipment that it cannot make and with a military doctrine built around equipment it might not ever have again. Some allies drag their feet or change their mind. Ukrainians have used American military equipment to great effect, but the unreliability of those supplies, because of President Biden's fear of antagonizing Russia and Trump's usual favoritism toward Vladimir Putin, has hampered their war effort. Since Trump's return to office, traditional European allies have come to recognize, from his criticism of NATO, that they will need to rely more on their own resources for their security. The current munitions crunch could lead its Gulf partners to the same conclusion. If Saudi Arabia and other customers of the American defense industry start sourcing their military equipment elsewhere or making it themselves, the United States will lose out. Beyond improving America's military position and diplomatic leverage, arms exports have been a lucrative industry. If the United States appears less powerful and less reliable than it once was and is running through munitions faster than it can produce them, many more countries will follow Ukraine's example. The Pentagon is belatedly ramping up its efforts to develop less expensive self-guided weapons, but those initiatives so far seem inadequate to address the problem that the war with Iran has revealed, a gap between America's military needs and what it is capable of manufacturing quickly and cheaply. Today's second story. Influencers are the Sinaloa cartel's newest targets. Written by Kevin Seif. Last Tuesday night, I was eating sushi with a Mexican police chief in downtown Culiacan, a city that had momentarily flickered back to life amid a bloody cartel turf war. At the table next to us was a birthday party. The police chief ordered a salmon roll. Through the window, I could see groups of families and friends walking on the sidewalk past car dealerships and strip malls after months of self-imposed lockdown. Among them were three influencers who pulled up to a KFC down the street. They were dressed as food delivery workers, carrying insulated bags on their backs, joking with one another, and live-streaming everything with their phones. Cesar Gastelum, the group's frontman, had become famous for such innocuous pranks. Even as thousands were murdered by the cartels, Gastelum, a stocky, bearded 24-year-old, posted video of himself dancing in pajamas, dressing as a priest, sipping iced coffee. He had more than 700,000 followers on TikTok. It was the kind of incongruity that had drawn me to Culiacan, the capital of Sinaloa. The city is the center of the fiercest and most consequential battle between armed groups in Mexico, and I waited to untangle what was behind the surge of violence. From afar, it was difficult to tell whether someone like Gastelum was proof that the mundane and the horrific could coexist here, as they have for decades across Mexico, or whether he was a symbol of something else, the way drug cartels had quietly co-opted even the city's least likely protagonists. At about 8 o'clock, Gastelum and his friends were recording themselves, waiting for their fried chicken orders, when two men on a motorcycle drove past. "Those guys scare me," Gastelum said. He then seemed to regain his calm, joking about his skinny jeans in front of the camera when the motorcycle returned. It stopped momentarily in front of the three young men. The driver, wearing a black helmet with a face shield, raised a gun about 2 feet from Gastelum's head and fired. The live stream captured the moment of the bullet's impact and then went dark. Someone on the city's ambulance team texted me when the 911 call came in, and I ran across the street to the KFC. I got to the scene as police were arriving. Gastelum's body lay at a drive-thru's exit, a ribbon of blood streaming toward the sidewalk. A cluster of soldiers gathered nearby, some of them scrolling through Gastelum's TikTok feed. A small group of crime photographers were taking photos and uploading videos. As you can see, they have killed another influencer here in Culiacán, José Ángel Beltrán of Luz Noticias said, narrating on Facebook Live. Culiacán, for years the axis of Mexico's drug wars, is now the focus of a U.S. effort to demolish drug cartels, something President Trump has said he's willing to use military force to achieve. It is in many ways an understandable target. The Sinaloa cartel, which has administered the state for decades, is responsible for trafficking, millions of kilos of fentanyl, meth, and cocaine into the United States. The Justice Department has indicted both the Sinaloa governor and the Culiacán mayor for cooperating with the cartel. Several of its leaders are serving life sentences in the U.S., and others have been targeted by Mexican security forces using intelligence from the United States. And yet, so far, these actions have only deepened the civil war between two Sinaloa cartel factions, one run by the children and supporters of Joaquim El Chapo Guzman, the Chapitos, and the other run by the allies of Ismael El Mayo Zamba Garcia, the Mayos. In 2022, there were 476 homicides in Sinaloa. In 2025, it had 1,657. Government action against organized crime groups in Mexico has almost always had such an effect, increasing violence without significantly altering the flow of drugs into the United States. But the current Sinaloa turf war, la narcopandemia, locals call it, has created new categories of victims, far from the foot soldiers and hitmen targeted in previous spasms of violence. Now influencers and content creators are recruited by cartels to distribute their messages online, and university and vocational students have been kidnapped, presumably because their skills are needed by criminal groups. Each time a young person here is killed or vanishes, there are immediate questions about whom he or she might have been working for. When drug traffickers allegedly subsidize TikTok dances, a victim's innocence can be almost impossible to discern. As forensic police arrived at the KFC, Beltran told me that another TikToker had been killed a few blocks away months earlier. A fitness influencer, El Tata, was murdered while leaving a shopping center. The body of a YouTuber, El Pinke, was found showing signs that he had been gagged and bound. About a dozen other influencers in Sinaloa have been killed, kidnapped, or attacked. Each time, the Mexican government investigated whether the influencers had somehow been linked to one group and targeted by the other. Last year, an unidentified plane dropped thousands of flyers over Culiacan that accused a number of influencers and musicians of having ties to the Chapitos. Gastelum was not on that list. Standing in front of the crime scene as the forensic police hovered about Gastelum's body with flashlights, I asked Beltran why he thought a goofy live streamer would be a target in a cartel turf war. "Did you see he was wearing a cowboy hat?" Beltran asked me. "Cowboy hats have become a symbol of the Mayos faction of the cartel." The implication was that Gastelum, while performing juvenile pranks, had been making a subtle nod to one group's power. Online commenters rushed to make the same point. Beltran filmed one last video of Gastelum's body as it was taken away. Then he tapped me on the shoulder. Another victim had been found a half mile away, a man shot in the city's botanical garden after a screening of a Lady Gaga documentary. I went with him to cover it. When we got there, it was dark, and the body was lit by a streetlight. Beltran took his phone out and again and started streaming. "Hello again, everybody," he said. "It's another rough night in Culiacan." The next day I drove 30 minutes from downtown Culiacan to a neighborhood called Costa Rica on the outskirts of the city. I passed by several motorcyclists, who had their face covered by ski masks. These punteros, as they're called, have for years worked as low-level informants for the cartel. Even before the fracture of Sinaloa, the cartel was famous for its capacity to monitor every inch of Culiacan. In addition to deploying the punteros, it placed hundreds of cameras across the city and set up surveillance teams in residential neighborhoods. The Mexican government had surged hundreds of soldiers and National Guardsmen across the city, ostensibly to disrupt the criminal groups who have terrorized it. But the military presence is overwhelmingly performative. On the road to Costa Rica, I watched as punteros and soldiers nonchalantly drove past one another. I pulled up to the squat house of Marta Perez Guzman, whose son, David Antonio Rulas Perez, had been kidnapped by armed men along with his classmate Jose Isarias Ibarra Duarte. There were 2,154 disappearances in Sinaloa last year, but the kidnapping of Rulas, 22, and Ibarra, 23, had received more attention than most. These men were students at an aviation school in Culiacan, and many here suspected that they had been abducted to work on cartel aircraft. There was another notable fact. Ibarra is a U.S. citizen, born in Los Angeles. His mother, Graciela Duarte Valdez, had wondered whether that would be enough to nudge the U.S. government to act. After all, Trump had articulated on Truth Social posts and Fox News interviews his desire to intervene in Mexico. She had traveled to the closest U.S. consulate in the neighboring state of Sonora and made her case. Not only was her son still missing, but the Mexican Attorney General's office had obtained surveillance footage of the kidnapping and showed it to her. Through tears, Duarte described seeing footage of four men who wore ski masks and carried rifles getting out of a minivan and forcing her son and Rulas into a second car. It all took only a few seconds. She felt abandoned by the Mexican government's investigators, who asked questions suggesting that the boys had been working for a cartel faction before the kidnapping. When she went to the U.S. consulate, officials took notes and thanked her for coming. When I asked the State Department about the case, a spokesperson told me, in a statement, that it was, quote, aware of reports of the kidnapping of a U.S. citizen in Mexico, end quote, but did not elaborate. Duarte was despairing. She knew that just a small fraction of disappeared people were later found alive in Sinaloa. One day last year, she heard that Governor Ruben Roca Moya was visiting her neighborhood. She ran to meet him. "Please help," she told the governor, as she held a missing person poster with her son's photo and name on it. Roca told her he would try. A few months later, Duarte was skimming her Facebook feed for information about missing people and recovered bodies when she saw a news story that said Roca had been indicted by the United States for colluding with the cartel. The U.S. government had acted, but she would not bring herself to see the move as productive or helpful. Roca temporarily resigned and fled Culiacan. The Mexican government announced that it would support him until the U.S. showed more evidence of his collusion. "All I could think of was that I had begged that man for help," Duarte said. "But of course, he did nothing. He had been working for the cartel the whole time." About a third of Mexico is controlled by organized criminal groups, according to a U.S. government analysis. Culiacan, even during its most peaceful stretches, has been a prime example. The cartel presence here has never been subtle. One man in his early 20s told me that his childhood friends had been recruited to work in fentanyl labs and would return smelling like chemicals for weeks. The children of cartel kingpins enrolled in the city's top prep schools. In one cemetery, families of deceased cartel operatives erected graves the size of suburban homes. Each time the cartel's fractures sent the city into spirals of violence, in 2010 and 2017, they ended the same way, not with the disintegration of organized crime, but with one faction emerging as the victor. As Cesar Gastelum's body was buried last week, some of the city's influencers posted tributes to him, as if describing a fallen comrade. "We need to take care of ourselves," one wrote to his 2.3 million followers. Even Mexico's president weighed in, promising to find the assailants. Duarte had followed the news. Gastelum was just a year older than her son. But she was following another story more closely. The government had detained a dozen young alleged cartel operatives in a rural area outside Culiacan. It published photos of the boys and men, their faces blurred. Many of their T-shirts were off, revealing skinny frames. Duarte zoomed in on one of them. It was hard to tell, but he looked at least a little bit like her son. Next, Tehran has to make a choice, by Arash Azizi. When the leaders of Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, and Turkey got together last week to forge a new defense agreement, they emphasized that their pact wasn't aimed at any particular country, but one country was surely on everybody's mind, the Islamic Republic of Iran. Iran has positioned itself as the most overtly anti-Western state in the region, and the coming together of three prominent Muslim-majority countries aligned with the West, two of which have land borders with Iran, signals its isolation. Iran has endured months of war with Israel and the United States without losing, but it has done so in part by repeatedly attacking neighboring countries that house U.S. military bases. Now these countries are among those closing ranks against Iran in an agreement signed in and named for Mecca, Islam's holiest city. The symbolism can't be lost on Tehran. The parties to the Mecca Pact include some of the world's most powerful Muslim-majority countries, the two with the biggest economies in the region, Turkey and Saudi Arabia, and the Muslim world's sole nuclear power, Pakistan. Iran has traditionally maintained good relations with Turkey and Pakistan. Its cultural bonds with these two countries are strong and go back centuries. More recently, the Islamic Republic has worked to improve its relations with Saudi Arabia, particularly since reestablishing diplomatic ties with Riyadh in 2023. Even so, Iran's regional policies have put the country at odds with these and other neighbors. Tehran gave its full support to the regime of Bashar al-Assad in Syria, which rebels who were backed by Ankara and Riyadh overthrew in 2024. The Iranian military exchanged strikes with Pakistan in 2024 and attacked Saudi Arabia in recent weeks. Iranian missiles were intercepted over the Turkish airspace earlier this year. Tehran-backed militias in Yemen and Iraq have attacked Saudi interests. More broadly, Iran's anti-American stance clashes with the official orientations of all three signatories of the Mecca Agreement. Iranian officialdom has mostly greeted the news of this pact with studied nonchalance. A spokesperson claimed to welcome the arrangement as evidence that the member countries would no longer rely on the United States. A reformist civil society activist suggested to me that the Mecca Agreement would be an opportunity, not a threat, insinuating that Iran could one day join it. But some hard-line politicians are less sanguine. Ibrahim Azizi, the head of the Parliament's Foreign Policy Committee, posted on Saturday that the Mecca Three haven't found the right path yet. We warn them about miscalculations. No mistake will go unanswered. Washington has long encouraged its allies in the Middle East to work together. Throughout much of the Cold War, regional alliances held off both Soviet communism and Arab radicalism, which meant that the United States felt the need to intervene only rarely and briefly. Iran was a crucial part of this architecture, intervening, together with Saudi Arabia, in civil wars in Oman and Yemen to help defeat communist-backed rebels, and helping to found the Organization of Islamic Cooperation in 1969. Iran is not the only Middle Eastern country excluded from the emerging security agreement that Mecca portends. Israel, too, is absent. The 2020 Abraham Accords normalized Israel's relations with the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan, but the big prize has always been Saudi Arabia, which has conditioned recognition of Israel on progress toward the formation of a Palestinian state. If Israel still wants to work toward regional recognition, it may find its best course is to patch things up with Turkey and try to meet the Saudis halfway. At least these two countries don't share the depth of Iran's animus toward Israel. Iran, too, will be faced with a choice. It can go on supporting militias and destabilizing the region, which will further isolate it. Or it can embrace the regional consensus on economic development, diplomatic reconciliation, and a two-state solution to the Israel-Palestine conflict. The Islamic Republic can either militate against Mecca, in other words, or give up its revolutionary ambitions at last. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Please join us next time. We hope you've enjoyed listening. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.